Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And I'd like to introduce the speakers tonight who will be speaking about elder abuse and the financial consequences of it. Okay. One speaker is Dr. Jonathan Kanick. He's been here before, and people found his information extremely helpful. He's a psychologist and a neuropsychologist. He's at the Department of Neurology and Psychology at California Pacific Medical Center. He's an assistant clinical professor at UCSF. And he's a popular lecturer here in San Francisco, often speaking upon cognitive capacity, aging, and other related issues in neuropsychology. The second speaker is David Baer, trial attorney in trust and estates litigation is his total focus. He frequently litigates claims of elder abuse. He's a member of the board of directors of the East Bay Trust and Estates Lawyers Association, and he's a former chair of the State Bar's Trust and Estates Bar Association. They have done many joint presentations at bar associations across the state, and it's an important issue to get details on. I'm glad that some of you who have an interest in this are going to be able to get that kind of detailed information from two experts in the field. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, George. Thank you for that introduction. And thank you for inviting us to talk here today. Thank you also for showing up. In fact, kudos for you for showing up, because this is a topic that people don't want to hear much about. This is a topic that exposes the underbelly of human nature. It's an epidemic, and it's a growing one. But it's disturbing, so people don't want to know about it, which is part of the reason why it is coined the silent crime of the 21st century. It's growing, it's increasing. Roughly 16% of all elderly are abused, and very few cases get reported. Roughly 95% of the cases do not get reported. There are no marks or disfiguring results on the individual, and so most people don't know even if it has happened to them. It is a common precursor to emotional abuse, abandonment, physical abuse, and even homicide. The National Protective Services Agency profiles the typical abuse of financial elder abuse victim as a woman in her 70s who's alone, isolated, cognitively impaired, and has some resources. There are many ways in which this type of abuse occurs, but all of it relates to and requires that you have trusted someone. Maybe it is that person who you've appointed as your power of attorney in that time when you are dependent and needy. Maybe it is a trustee. My colleague Mr. Baer is going to discuss how sometimes lawyers are the perpetrators of this. Perhaps it's a financial advisor, not showing up too well, or planner, who you've entrusted your retirement savings with, who has instead decided to invest according to what is in his or her best interest. So why are the elderly targets of financial abuse? Why is this happening? Well, one of the answers to that question is a very simple answer. It's the same answer Willie Sutton gave when asked, why do you rob banks? And the answer is, because that's where the money is. There is a disproportionate amount of wealth among elderly individuals in our society. It's not just that programs like Medicare and Social Security have been very, very helpful in preventing elderly from being homeless, but they have accumulated a lot of wealth. And, for example, if you live in the Bay Area and 40 years ago or so you bought a house and maybe you were a secretary or a school teacher, you could afford to. Now you're a millionaire. The wealth gap between the young and old has grown dramatically over the decades. Presently, it is estimated that the net worth of a 65-year-old or older is 47 times that of someone who's 35 and younger. Now, again, we live in the Bay Area, and there's probably a collection of below 35 millionaires and billionaires, unlike elsewhere, but by and large, the vast majority of wealth is with the elderly population. Between 1984 and 2009, the wealth and net worth of those 65 and older has increased by 42%, according to Pew Research, while at the same time, the net wealth of 35 and youngers has decreased by 68%. One reason for financial elder abuse is not because we mentally disintegrate as we age. Aging is not a neurodegenerative process. It does not by itself result in significant cognitive decline. It can be confused with different types of effects that acquire and accumulate over time, but that's not aging. Aging does not result in a loss of cognitive capacity. You don't become incompetent at some point as a normal stage of aging. So what is cognitive capacity? Well, embedded in the concept and idea of cognitive capacity is that you have the functions that enable you to assert and protect your best interests, that you have the capacities needed to understand and express different choices, to appreciate the consequences of those choices, and then to choose and execute and follow through with those given choices. This involves a hierarchy of abilities. Now, I said those statements, and you heard them very reflexively. We do these things automatically, and it's only when something unfortunate happens, like a stroke or a dementia, that we really appreciate how remarkable our brains are and our cognition is. But these are involved functions. There's many abilities that are needed in order to understand. And there's a hierarchy of abilities. So if a person is to understand, they have to have good sensory processes. They have to be able to see, to be able to hear. They have to be able to remember information that they had and learn new information as might be relevant to a given situation. If we're talking about appreciate, then we're talking about needing to be able to use those notational symbols called numbers and symbolic reasoning, and to be able to fathom assets and how much we want to apportion one way or another. And then if we're talking about executing and choosing and applying, well, now we're talking about the higher cortical and cognitive abilities that we have. Because if you're going to think about your future, you absolutely have to be able to reason abstractly, because the future is an abstraction. There is nobody in this room who could point to and show me where the future is. You have to envision a time and place when you don't exist. That's a pretty impressive feat that we do, and we take it for granted. Testamentary, contractual, there are many different types of capacities. And given a capacity in mind, you need to have a certain degree of ability. To make an informed medical decision, you might need a certain level. To make a will or change a will, another level still. To function perhaps as a professional, still another level yet. All of these different capacities require competent voluntary agreement. And the increased incidence of illness, disability, medication use, dementia, as we are living longer, should raise concern about whether a person truly has the capacity to do a certain act, because, again, there is no look that a person with capacity has or someone without capacity. Now, making a bad decision does not mean you lack capacity. Truth be told, I've made a couple of bad decisions in my life, and I'm going to make a couple of more. We have the right to make bad decisions. We have the right to make arbitrary decisions. You can leave your estate to your cats if you are competent and so wish to do. It's called the right to folly. Now, as we age, there are increasing risks we face that can accumulate and increase the vulnerability that an elderly person has to fraud and exploitation. So if you have really bad habits that you continue on throughout your life, and you, for example, you smoke or you drink heavily, you abuse drugs, illicit or pharmaceutical, you're going to become compromised. That's not aging. That's the cumulative effects of those things. If you have a deficiency, perhaps a folic acid deficiency, a B12 deficiency, if it goes untreated, you will become cognitively compromised. But that's not aging. And you will become more vulnerable to exploitation. Medical problems, hypertension, diabetes, if these go untreated or undertreated, you too will become more compromised. Again, there's a variety of biological, psychological, social factors. As we age, our friends and we retire, we relocate, we change, we die. Things change that can increase the vulnerability of an elderly, older person. Now, while dementia is not a consequence of aging, the prevalence of it increases as we age. So by the time people are in their 90s, roughly 35% of the population in their 90s is thought to suffer some degree of dementia. Now, keep in mind, 65% don't. This will, though, again, make one more vulnerable in terms of making informed decisions. Now, in considering dementia, most dementias are a top-down corrosion. And one of the first casualties of a dementia is oftentimes self-awareness. And if you lose self-awareness, you can't appraise your status and what you need. You can't be aware that you've made a mistake, and you can't correct yourself. You are in a vulnerable situation. If you can't execute or conceptualize things, you can't fathom and imagine the future in a realistic way. And so we see this kind of wearing down of these higher abilities, and person is left with all of those removed, but they're attentive, they're perceptive, and they look like you and me. By contrast, delirium, depression, which also the incidence of that increases as we age, is more from the bottom undermining effect. Now, both delirium and depression are treatable usually. But if you are delirious, whether because of an infection, a medication effect, an illness, you are almost by sure incapacitated. But these are intermittent, and you're likely to be able to regain your capacity. In this scenario, we see attention and vigilance. Those abilities are lost, and a whole system comes down, because if you don't attend to something, you can't remember something you have not attended to. You can't manipulate it or further consider it if it hasn't been attended to. Deficits in mental functioning should raise concern about the possibility that someone lacks the capacity to perform a certain task, make a will, make informed decisions, etc. Here are some abilities that I've already referred to: memory, conceptual abilities, abstraction. But you have to be able to plan and problem solve. You have to entertain the notion that, gee, if I change my will and I leave all of my money to my one child and nothing to the other, is that going to cause problems down the road? I want to problem solve that and fathom that in advance. And remarkably, again, people fail to do that. Now, I have language there as well, and it's really important that you have some way to express yourself, your preferences, as well as to receive and comprehend new information. But language can be a red herring, because you could have people who are very articulate, very conversant, with great vocabularies, who are very demented, and you don't know that. Conversely, there are people who lose language, maybe from a stroke or maybe from some other cause. It used to be thought that if you didn't have language, the word for you was dumb, as in deaf and dumb. Well, you can have plenty of cognition and cognitive ability even if you've lost regular language. I want to bring your attention to the bottom item, a signature. A signature doesn't mean anything. It is a highly overlearned automatic process that we've done millions of times. It does not convey any cognition whatsoever, just as having the inability to make a signature because your hand's been cut off or you have Parkinson's, that does not imply anything about you cognitively. My colleague, Mr. Baer, has pointed out to me that a signature is sort of like that bar you click, I accept, when you're updating your software. And it implies no more agreement or comprehension of what you've just signed off with than that. The field of neuroeconomics, I think, tells us something very important about the increased vulnerability that elderly individuals face in terms of financial exploitation. And it relates to both risk aversion and decision making, and there's a strong relationship between the two. The older you are, the less educated you are, the less income you have, the poorer decisions and more risk you're going to take. And that's been actually highly correlated, very well studied. The vulnerabilities that can increase risk aversion increase too with age. Some people lose what we call executive functions. Those are involved in regulating ourselves, like our emotion, our impulsivity. There are many thoughts that go through my mind that I do not act on, nor should I. But if you lose those controls, you are more prone to impulsivity. And yes, I want to score big before this game is over. I want to leave a big estate, so I'm going to make this investment in pork bellies. There is actually decreasing risk aversion in people over the age of 65. That's contrary to common sense. Now, part of what it shows up as is that older individuals are more risk averse when weighing potential losses, but not when weighing potential gains. One thing we have to come to terms with, this financial exploitation and elder financial exploitation, elder abuse, it's not being done by Martians. Al-Qaeda is not doing this. It's being done by those we depend on and trust the most. It does reflect the underbelly of human nature. And you know where you find it? Everywhere there's human nature. Because the minute you need to trust or depend, you've created the opportunity for betrayal or exploitation. And we can't get around that. That is, again, part of who we are. The Ten Commandments was not given out in the Garden of Eden. It was given out as this group of slaves try to become civilized. And they needed to be told, much as we do too, don't kill. Don't steal. Don't kill your neighbor in order to acquire his wife and property. Because this is human nature. And as Hieronymus Bosch pointed out with the Garden of Earthly Delights and the Seven Deadly Sins at the outset of the Renaissance, it does not matter how devout you are, how educated or cultured you are as vulnerable to the base impulses of being a human being as we all are. So who's doing it? Well, the Center for Elder Abuse at UC Irvine allowed me to use their slide here. This is who's doing it. Not exactly the picture of family values. Your adult children. Almost half of all elder financial abuse is perpetrated by them. It's by family members, spouses, caregivers, other people we rely and depend on. This is the human predicament. Now, you don't have to be cognitively impaired, grossly compromised to be defrauded. A lot of very smart, competent people in New York who were taken by this guy named Bernie Madoff. But boy, if you are dependent, if you are cognitively impaired, the risk of elder abuse, financial elder abuse, rises precipitously. There's a direct correlation between the amount of cognitive impairment present and the extent of elder abuse that will occur. And so the combination of the two, of dependency and impairments, significantly increases the risk of that. 50% of those with dementia suffer some form of elder abuse. So undue influence. Who's exposed to it? Who's vulnerable to it? Everyone. Each of us. Do you have to be cognitively compromised to suffer elder, to suffer undue influence? No. You can have cognitive capacity and be exploited and suffer undue influence. My colleague is going to describe this in greater detail. But there is a bunch of different factors that can increase the likelihood that undue influence is being employed. It does require a trusting relationship in order for it to happen. There's two different types of undue influence. Coercion is what it's about. One is overt coercion, where you're doing something you don't want to do, or you've agreed or signed off on something you really didn't want to. But more common is covert coercion, implicit, where somebody is doing you all kinds of favors and benefits, and they're your best new friend, and they feel that, you know, they're entitled, that they're really doing great things for you. So you really do in some way kind of owe them. That is the more common one, generating undeserved goodwill from the victim. Undue influence can also be increased by a variety of factors. Anything that impairs cognition increases the opportunity and chance of undue influence. Impaired, reduced mood control, significant social losses, certain personality types. So let's say you're an 85-year-old woman who's been in love with your husband for 60 years. And for the last 8 months, you've been watching him die in your home. And you've had caregiver come in to help take care of him. And you were held together by him emotionally and in all kinds of ways. And he dies. And that 45-year-old caregiver announces his undying love for you and suggests you go off to Reno to get married. You're going to do that. And you could be sure she had millions of dollars in the bank. I'm happy to say that that was remedied in the court, in a case that I was involved in. Red flags that might alert you to this is that there's changed routines. They used to always come by the senior center. They used to always see family and friends. We don't see them anymore. Red flag. You know? Phone calls, mail intercepted, things like that, special secret trips. Maybe you're like this elderly woman who was actually a dentist who had a large family, and people didn't think much that the niece, the great niece, was taking her out. Nobody knew exactly where and what was going on, but everyone was sure surprised when they found out that her house was sold for 10% of its value. Changes in finances. These now are some things that you might not ever know. An altered will or a trust, you might not, that might not see the light of day. Loans, gifts, jewelry that's being given to a child or to someone else. Loss of property. These are all red flags. Susan Bernatz, a psychologist in Los Angeles who works in this area, has a little method of identifying this by the word scam. It involves susceptibility. You need to be elderly, vulnerable. Perhaps you're alone and isolated, have some cognitive impairment, and you have resources. You have to have a confidential relationship with the perpetrator, someone you know, someone you trust and rely on. Is there evidence that there has been active procurement? Like I said, maybe jewelry has been given away or special loans and gifts without any strings attached. Monetary loss, oftentimes this signals that elder financial abuse has occurred. And so it was with Mr. O, an 84-year-old miserly curmudgeon of a man. He did not like people, and people did not like him. And he was cheap. So he had no will, no power of attorney, none of the type of legal tools or items that would have been of help to protecting him. And as he got old, so did his siblings, and they grew distant. They didn't see or hear of each other much. So when Bill showed up and offered to help repair Mr. O's house in exchange for some rent accommodations, he was all too happy to do that. And he didn't realize that Bill was no longer paying rent, and that Bill was helping him now out with picking up the food and the medications and the mail. And boy, what happened to my family? I've sent them cards, and those bastards have never gotten back to me. Well, when the police broke down the door, because you see, Bill wanted to visit his family, so he left Mr. O tied up to a chair for several days, sitting in his feces and urine, where he hadn't eaten, and so forth. They found the next room was filled with mail, was filled with meals from Meals on Wheels, all kinds of things. That the room had no clocks, no calendars, all the shades were pulled. You wouldn't know what century you were in inside that room. Well, it so happens I got to see Mr. O because he was admitted to the hospital and I was asked to evaluate him. And he was barely competent when I saw him, and I saw him under good conditions. He was doing better. But it was interesting because one thing he couldn't do was sign his name. So when 2 weeks later he died and Bill came forward with a one-line page saying, I leave everything to my good friend Bill, all $10 million, we were able to address that. But these are the kind of crimes that go on routinely. They are happening and will be happening increasingly, and there's little we know about it and little attention that is given to it. My colleague, Mr. Baer, is now going to describe some of the kind of legal remedies that Mr. Owen, you, and others might take in addressing these issues.
Thank you very much, Dr. Koenig. So my practice focuses on trust and estates litigation. A big part of that for me is the neuropsychological aspects of that. Obviously, cognition relates directly to testamentary capacity, the ability to make a will or a trust. Also, cognition relates a lot to susceptibility to undue influence. But mostly, of course, what I work on is the legal side of things. So that's primarily what I'm going to talk about. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about a case that I was involved in about 10 or 12 years ago involving a retired dentist, Norman Jensen. Norman Jensen lived up on Pacific Heights in a house that his parents had built in the 1950s. He never married. He had no kids. He used to rule the roost at his dental office building, more or less. But as the years went by and he became quite isolated, he was more or less falling apart. He had graduated from UC Dental School, and he had a connection through there with a guy who was a rugby player who kind of helped out in taking care of him for a while. But then he went up to Seattle. And at that point, his next-door neighbor had a daughter in her, I guess, 30s. She was kind of a little bit down on her luck and moved back home. She noticed, back in with her mom, she noticed Dr. Jensen not too long after, more or less invited herself into his house, found that he had a few million bucks in by looking at the financial account records that he had laying out, and basically she decided to kind of doll him up and try to become his conservator. So I have a little clip, if I can make it work. Let's see. Am I moving the mouse?
No, the cursor.
The cursor, that's fine.
Move it down a little bit. There you go. Push on, click on it. There you go, click.
Maybe you're right, yeah. Right.
Now you're a smart man. You haven't lost your brains, you know. You're a smart man. You're just temporarily under the weather here, and you're coming out of it very fast. So you want to do everything you can to bring yourself into, you know, good situation.
I will consider myself healed, improved in health.
I think a lot of people might witness that and not really understand what's happening. At that point, Dr. Jensen was basically putty. He was totally susceptible to undue influence. There's nothing evil about what his good friend, his colleague who had also been a dentist, was saying to him. But the reality of the matter was that a week before, he'd basically been in rags. His neighbor had dressed him up pretty well there. His friend was telling him that he was coming out of it, and he just agreed with that. Dr. Jensen at that point would pretty much agree with anything. So let me talk now a little bit about how California law has evolved to try to prevent and punish elder abuse. I'd have to point out that to some extent there's a price that's paid for that, because all these different laws that prevent and protect elder abuse also have some tendency to, I would say, result in the instability of estate plans by making them considerably more easy to attack. And so that poses kind of a corresponding problem of making sure that when you have a legitimate estate plan, that it's at your wishes are actually going to be carried out. So just very briefly as an overview, actually there was really no such thing as suing over financial elder abuse until 1994. It has not, it's a very recent element actually of California law. At the same, in the very same year, due to a completely unethical and criminal, really, lawyer down in, it was in Southern California, it wasn't Northern California.
There are no criminal lawyers.
Right. The law changed to create a presumption that certain individuals, if they're left gifts, that those have been procured by undue influence or fraud. Then in 1999, a law was enacted that basically, kind of like murder, prevented someone who'd committed elder abuse from inheriting from the victim. That's been cut back a little bit since then. In 2005, the law was changed again so that someone who's sued for elder abuse has to pay, if they lose, the attorney's fees that are incurred by the plaintiff. And in addition, and this has radically changed my practice, but in 2009, essentially estate planning became the subject of elder abuse laws. So now it's not just the case that if an elder loses their own assets while they're alive that you can sue, that someone can sue for elder abuse, but also if it can be shown that an elder had his or her estate plan procured by undue influence, that that's also actionable elder abuse. Then in 2010, for the most part, no contest clauses disappeared from the face of California law. Those two, somewhat surprisingly, were a tool of elder abusers. And then most recently, the definition of undue influence, while the legislature has said this isn't really so, basically it did expand the definition quite a bit and make it easier to sue for elder abuse. So one secondary and I would say prophylactic effect of this is that basically suing over financial elder abuse can be a pretty good way to make a living for lawyers. It's possible to get lawyers to take contingency fee cases in this area, and I would say that without somebody out there to civilly prosecute these kind of cases, the laws wouldn't really mean much. But they've basically changed so much in the last 20 years that there are lots of attorneys that are interested in this area of law and want to take on these kind of cases. So I'll talk in a little bit more detail about some of these laws, but basically, as I said, in 1994, the legislature decided we're going to let people sue for committing, sue somebody who's committed elder abuse. At first, the law was kind of limited, only fiduciaries could be sued, but now anybody who commits elder abuse can be sued. And in addition, the attorney's fees law that I talked about, it's basically a one-way street. If somebody is sued for elder abuse and loses, they need to pay or they're required to pay the plaintiff's attorney's fees. Somebody who's wrongfully accused of elder abuse and wins or basically settles the case on favorable terms, they can't get their attorney's fees back. So it really puts a lot of pressure on someone who's accused of elder abuse to in some way settle the case, because it gets very expensive to defend the litigation and very risky. The only other thing I'd point out about that is unless the elder abuser is fairly well healed to begin with, there's not necessarily anything to lose other than the gift. So, as I said, 2009, the legislature said, if you commit undue influence of an elder and you procure somebody's a gift via an estate plan, an at-gift transfer, that's actionable elder abuse. And so what has happened is, essentially, every will contest, every trust contest is also elder abuse litigation, because basically there's not too many will or trust contests except those of deceased elders. So in 1994, basically California law changed pretty radically because of the conduct of a fellow named James Gunderson down in Orange County. Mr. Gunderson had a practice right next to Leisure World. He had thousands of clients that he prepared wills for, and the wills he prepared, obviously, by the reaction I'm getting, left Mr. Gunderson gifts. And Mr. Gunderson included in these wills no contest provisions, which basically said to the other family members, if you contest the gift that this will leaves to me, the drafting attorney, then you lose everything. And so he was able through these to basically intimidate a lot of family members to take very little or nothing more than the will that Mr. Gunderson had prepared when they found out what happened. And somewhat cynically, as the article mentions, when Mr. Gunderson was asked to comment on all this, he said he couldn't. I'm bound by the attorney-client privilege. Not many people really know this. In fact, not that many attorneys outside the trust and estates area know this. But basically, when the issue of intent of a client is at stake in connection with the client's estate plan, there is no attorney-client privilege. The information all sees the light of day, because obviously the attorney has the most relevant information to the estate plan. So Mr. Gunderson was dealt with, but one of the other things that happened was that the legislature basically created this statute that creates a rebuttable presumption that certain kinds of people, certain categories of people who receive gifts have procured those gifts by fraud or undue influence. So at the top of the list, is the person who has drafted the document. Obviously, that's aimed at lawyers like Mr. Gunderson. And there's some teeth in that as well, in that it doesn't work for the attorney to draft a will leaving a major gift to his spouse or her spouse, his or her law partner. Those are also prohibited. But the most significant aspect of this law, actually, certainly the most litigated, was its presumption that the care custodian of a dependent adult has procured the gift by undue influence. That's really been the principal target of this legislation in litigation, and really it's quite rather broad. Anybody who's provided health or social services to the dependent adult is basically a care custodian. There's some limitations there, obviously. Well, maybe I shouldn't say obviously, but a family member who helps out an elder is not within the scope of this statute. One might sort of wonder why that's the case after looking at some of the statistics that the sad statistics, really, that Dr. Kanick presented. I think they show something like half of the financial elder abuse committed by children, about two-thirds of it by children or spouses, and about 80% of it by some relative. But I don't really think it would be too politically feasible for the California legislature to establish a presumption that a family member has procured a will by fraud or undue influence. That would be a little bit extreme. Anyway, there was a lot of controversy about this for a while. Initially, the statute actually had no exception for someone who happened to receive a gift from a dependent adult, and it helped care for this person without getting any kind of compensation, without being a professional, even if it was just, you know, a friend or neighbor who had a prior relationship with the decedent, the so-called Good Samaritan. And basically the Supreme Court ruled a few years back that these good Samaritans were had presumptively procured their gifts by fraud or undue influence too, and the legislature responded by creating another exception to the law. And there's some other categories of people that are considered prohibited donees. Fiduciaries who transcribe a will is one category. That's essentially that one instance may be the deathbed will is sort of taken down, and the neighbor says to an attorney, "Here's what you know my neighbor wants," and the attorney prepares a will, and that gets signed. I had a case involving exactly those facts, where about probably 80% of a $7 or $8 million estate of a man in Berkeley was left to his neighbor and his neighbor's children, and they had a typical neighborly relationship, I would say. Anyway, if I haven't made it clear, this presumption, it is rebuttable. It's not automatic that you don't, if you're one of these people, you don't get a gift. And this statute, like the elder abuse statute, it's got a one-way attorney's fees provision, so that if you're in one of these categories and you're sued, if you lose, you pay the plaintiff's attorney's fees. If you win, you just basically get your gift. So, the no contest clause. The way a no contest clause works basically is this. It's kind of like the carrot and stick. A significant gift is left to a beneficiary, but the beneficiary is basically told by the will or the trust that if you try to contest this will or trust, you get nothing, or you get a dollar. It doesn't work unless there's a significant gift of some sort, and that's what Mr. Gunderson knew. Essentially, those were enforceable under California law until around 2010, I believe. At that point, the legislature basically said, this is being used the wrong way. This is being used by elder abusers who want to protect their gifts and are smart enough to actually prepare stuff or have stuff prepared that leaves the beneficiaries something meaningful, but not the whole estate. And so what happened was, the legislature said, okay, you can freely contest a will or a trust amendment, any kind of at-death transfer now, and as long as you had reasonable cause to do that, the no contest clause is unenforceable. So basically, no contest clauses are pretty much toothless except for those cases that are actually tried. And so, as I say below, it really is only a significant deterrent if you're going to leave the beneficiary something under the will. On the other hand, this was long considered in California a legitimate tool, especially where there's, I would say, some controversy in the estate plan, but not really any doubt as to competence or undue influence, to prevent contests, to basically try to keep siblings from starting wars with one another. That's not really a very effective tool anymore. They don't really stop lawsuits. And then most recently, the definition of undue influence has changed fairly radically in some ways. I think the first part there, excessive persuasion overcoming a person's free will, I think that's been a given for quite some time. The follow-on that results in inequity, that is rather subjective. These cases, by the way, are tried to courts, not juries. But nonetheless, I would have to say that, like beauty, inequity is pretty much in the eye of the beholder. Factors indicative of undue influence, these actually tie in very well to what Dr. Kanick was talking about, vulnerability through impaired cognitive function, isolation, dependency, the abuser's apparent authority. The sort of list of people who are in apparent authority, those rather broad, family members, fiduciaries, caregivers, medical providers, lawyers, spiritual advisors. I'm not quite sure what beneficiaries are outside that category except possibly charities. They did tend to do fairly well in this kind of litigation. Undue influence, another factor, controlling the necessaries of life. The person who can, you know, get the can of soup off the shelf can become a pretty critical factor to to life as the years advance. I think, to me, rather interestingly, is another factor actually now is not just sort of negative interactions, but positive ones. The use of affection is indicative of undue influence potentially now. The kind of changes in estate plans that occur sort of completely undercover, inappropriate places, when the person doesn't really know what's going on, they're woken up and asked to sign something, things like that. And then the inequity part, the statute talks about this as being changes, and then more or less states a value judgment, gifts that are inappropriate given the length and nature of the elder's relationship. Whoops, it should be with the donee, not with the done. But anyway, that really sort of calls into question actually what Dr. Kinnick was talking about, the right to folly, the right to be arbitrary, just because, you know, you make a decision that maybe other people wouldn't make doesn't mean that you didn't really fully understand what you were doing and do it consciously. But this, again, I would say this is one of the factors that, in my mind anyway, while helpful in combating or remedying elder abuse, also makes it quite feasible. It contributes to what I call the instability of estate plans. Okay, so let me talk a little bit. Many of you may have some concerns about friends in your life. You may have your own concerns about what can you do to detect and prevent elder abuse. I would have to say it's a difficult subject. I think it's probably easier to commit elder abuse than to prevent elder abuse, to be honest. I would say really lying at the heart of this, frankly, is caring about the people that you know and love, and their willingness to be open and honest with you. Unless you kind of have a sense of what's going on, it's a difficult problem. But it takes, I would say, a conscious effort to stay in touch. From the legal perspective of things, I'd have to say that disability planning is really far more important than estate planning. What is going to happen if you are unable to cognitively care for yourself anymore? Who is going to be in charge of your affairs? Is it going to be one person alone? Is it going to be more than one person? I would have to say that while it becomes cumbersome to have two or more people responsible for your financial affairs, it does also have the tendency to prevent someone from running amok because there's a little bit more accountability with two people involved. There needs to be some sort of reasonable procedures for replacing a parent or a senior as a trustee. They can't really be too difficult. They certainly can't be too easy either. I would suggest there that a lot of times when those kinds of things occur, it may be well to, in estate plans, have requirements that others receive notice that this is occurring, that it not just simply be done between the attorney and the client. I think that is atypical. Usually attorney-client relationships are sort of considered sacrosanct, but if you keep things that way, you actually increase the possibility or probability of elder abuse. I really think that part of the key to this is to have open family discussions about what the senior wants. What do they want? I mean, they need to be early. If they're too late, they're pointless. But if there's some pretty clear discussions about what the financial circumstances are, what the senior wants, why they want those things, and they're not just with one person, basically you have something of a record to try to counteract secretive behavior that may occur later. It's important to select reputable professional caregivers. A lot of in-home groups make it basically, it's against the rules essentially to try to solicit anything from the elder, and that's certainly grounds for termination. I think those are good rules. I think a lot of people might sort of weigh the pros and cons and think it's worth it to take a chance, and they're still going to commit elder abuse. I think a lot of other people don't want to lose their job. Again, involvement in your senior's life is important. You know, I think back on Dr. Jensen, and he had sort of nobody, but not quite entirely. He had a second cousin who lived in Novato, and they had kind of a on-again, off-again relationship for years. I in no way fault his second cousin for not getting more involved in his life. But on the other hand, it was apparent that pretty much Dr. Jensen had nobody. And he certainly could have, it wasn't incumbent on him to, but he could have tried to stay a bit more involved in Dr. Jensen's life. He actually became a critical witness at the trial because he really did understand a lot about Dr. Jensen and the things that interested him and his values and motivations. But to some extent, that was too late. Being able to talk to your parents' health care providers or a senior's health care providers, it's actually kind of a difficult thing these days with HIPAA. But so it's good to put in place consents to do that. It's good to try to basically encourage as many people as possible to care about, you know, the senior that you care about, to try to keep, I put it, their horizons, to keep their horizons as broad as possible. It's when the world kind of shrinks that people become, I think, most vulnerable. And the last thing I think is really important is to be sensitive to changes in the senior, to not just, deny that they're occurring. It's very easy to do that. I think actually in the video clip, it was only 30 seconds, but you could see Dr. Jensen's dentist colleague saying, you know, you're getting back on your feet. He was dressed better that day was the reality. Anyway, I don't know if any of this would have helped Norman Jensen necessarily or not. I mean, that's in large part what the law is about, but it can make a difference in, I would say, in many seniors' lives to stay involved. I think that's all the time I have.
I'd like to remind our audience that they're listening to David Baer and Jonathan Kanick speaking about the epidemic of financial elder abuse, and we'll take questions.
Well, I really thought this was really excellent. I just wanted to say that for aging people, they often have their own denial. We sort of implied that, but not quite that directly. And it seems to me that they have to be or somehow get some insight into the potential for these things and plan while they still can plan, and hopefully avoid a lot of these things. In my own experience as a professional, I was shocked at first when I saw how often this occurred. It's almost like it happens a lot more than it doesn't. But anyway, that's my thought.
Well, yeah, can I just respond to that very briefly? I completely agree with that. I think one of the most typical behaviors when people at least start to become demented is masking, is concealing, you know, the fact that you're starting to struggle. And I would say the smarter you are to begin with, the easier it is to kind of do that. And so I think really awareness of this issue is most critical among people that really are fully competent, because the sad reality is that it can happen to you, and you need to take steps to prevent it from happening to you while you best can.
I would like to just add that, again, and a great question, Bob. Thanks for asking that or mentioning your ideas. Self-awareness is one of the first casualties. We even have a term for it in neuropsychology. It's called agnosognosia, not knowing what you don't know. And when you don't know what you don't know, there is no problem.
This isn't exactly a question, but when you mentioned that seniors, probably part of the problem is because seniors have so much money, it reminded me of the Social Security raise I just received a few months ago, $3 a month.
They're not getting rich from Social Security.
Let's hope that.
Tell me how the DAs are involved. I'm also curious if who sued on behalf of Mr. Jensen. But Are the district attorneys getting involved in this?
My experience is more on the civil side than the criminal side. I think that the DAs are much more involved when a senior is actually still alive. I mean, after that, kind of the damage has been done. I would also say that when there's civil litigation, the DAs won't get involved because they basically feel that the issue is being addressed one way or another, at least with respect to financial elder abuse.
And who sued on
behalf of... Oh, I'm sorry. So what... It's kind of a long story, but the bottom line of it is that there were four charities that sued on behalf of essentially to recover gifts that had been procured by the videographer in that film was his next-door neighbor, but it was KQED. At the time, what was San Francisco Hospital for Shriners Hospital for Crippled Children? That's a great name for a plaintiff. The San Francisco Conservatory of Music and the University of California. And Dr. Jensen actually had been a concert-level pianist, and he loved watching KQED. And it was really only very coincidentally that the charities learned that his conservator had basically gotten him to sign a will that left everything to her. It was 1 month after the court appointed her.
And in the post-Bernie Madoff era, the FBI has actually opened up more units around the country to investigate multi-million dollar fraud and exploitation.
Yes, we're seeing agencies open up all over the place offering in-home health care. There's an Alzheimer's hospital opening two blocks from my office. How do people check out and what resources do they have to find out if these people or these organizations are professional and licensed or whatever? They're popping up all over. In our neighborhood, we have care homes with four and five people living in them in residential areas and charging $5,000 and $6,000 a month for the senior person to live there. That's my first question. The second one, could you comment on the recent news article of the judge who was convicted here in Oakland for elder abuse?
The first part is a very, very tough. I don't know how possible it is because all of these agencies, they will actually advertise that they check out and vet their people. And yet the case that I described of the caregiver that ran off to Reno and married the 85-year-old woman turned out when the court case got going, he had had a criminal past. In the case of Mr. O, the person who had perpetrated the crime had been fired from a bank for embezzlement. So the dirty laundry, you don't necessarily get to, and it is remarkable how much more seems to become apparent or you're able to get to and find out once the crime has been committed. So I think it's actually a huge, huge problem. And so in the first case, the caregiver was fired when they found out that he married one of the patient's wife. $50,000 a year, $4 million. He did the calculus and, went accordingly.
I'd have to say, personally, I'm a small sample size. But the great majority of my cases that have involved elder abuse have involved elders that basically were isolated and still living in their home, not in some sort of facility, not by people working in that facility. Some of the case law on the topic involves people working in facilities, but most often when the relationship sort of started there and then the senior went back home and then the senior was exploited. So actually, to some extent, my perception anyway is that being in a place where there's sort of more people around is something of a deterrent because there's more supervision of the employees and it depends, of course, this isn't categorical, but there's just basically more people watching what's happening.
What can you put in a will so that an only sibling, for instance, that you've had past experience based on their actions and currently, not only currently, but for years you have no contact with any longer,
is that only the amount that you specify in the will is what they receive, and that they can't challenge in any way whatever is left.
Okay, so that's kind of a complicated question, but first of all, it kind of depends on whether there are other beneficiaries.
No.
And
no.
The only beneficiary.
The only living relative, literally, would be that person. The brother died, so he's not involved. And at this point, there is, as I say, for years now, no longer any contact, but she would be of the temperament that the odds could be, that she would look to challenge beyond the limited, very limited, compared to what would be left amount in the will.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm a little hazy on your question exactly. Do you want the sibling?
Well, no, absolutely not, other than the amount specified.
Oh, other than the amount specified.
Right.
Okay, well, I mean, a lot of it really depends upon things that have happened in the past. I mean, there's the possibility, if the person is still competent, that they can execute essentially another estate planning document without even changing the plan. You know, you can have a will one day and you can do the exact same will the next day.
Yeah.
And then to succeed in setting them aside, you have to set aside two wills. And so
I don't understand now what you're saying, because why would the will that you had already written not be applicable?
It could be, but you might not have as much evidence relating to what happened at that time to be able to uphold its validity. So, for example, if you do a will a second time, you can have the person go get a neuropsychological examination from Dr. Kanick, who can conclude, if it's true, that the person is perfectly competent to make their decisions. And then it becomes much more difficult to set aside that choice. There's some other things that can potentially be done as well, good attorney notes, documents just written in the hand of testator to explain what it is they want, that isn't just, you know, the legal document.
So that $1 challenge is not valid.
You mean the no contest clause?
Right.
It's not a meaningful deterrent. You can't count on that. You really can't count on that.
That's what
anymore.
I really wanted to know.
Yeah.
If there was a simple way to do something like that.
It's not. And that's part of what I was talking about. These laws certainly have a prophylactic effect and they have a remedial effect. But they also have the effect of making it a lot easier to contest legitimate estate plans. You know, it's kind of like an amoeba. You push one end in here and the other end kind of goes out there. It's a little bit of an equilibrium. And it's made it more important, I would say, to take some measures to ensure that legitimate estate planning choices are enforceable.
Thank you.
There's time for one more question.
Thank you. So how would you suggest we go about finding a durable power of attorney? Phone book?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Finding one or finding an attorney to prepare one? I mean, who's going to exercise the authority? Oh, okay, who's going to make the choices? I mean, you have to have trusted people in your life. I would suggest that if you have some doubts about that, that you might be better off appointing a private professional fiduciary to make those decisions, or having an arrangement where, you know, it depends on what your wealth is, but for your financial affairs, having someone in your family, but then also a financial institution and a private professional fiduciary, so that these decisions are not just made unilaterally.
A trust officer at a bank, for example.
Potentially, yeah. Right.
Right. That was short enough.
I have a quick question. There was a case that I was involved with where a family member was concerned about the mental condition of another family member and wanted to contact that family member's psychiatrist. Of course, there is a law where psychiatrist, therapist cannot divulge anything about the client without that client's permission. And the client said, they don't have my permission. So under what situation then would family members will be able to access information about the loved one whom they suspect of being mentally unable to take care of themselves?
Do you
you want to address that or do you want to do it?
Okay, so I have, that's fine. So I have basically, I guess, three different ideas there. One is to, depends what you think has happened. If you think anything significant has happened as opposed to just that the person is slipping, a report can be made to Adult Protective Services and they will investigate. Another possibility, while you cannot get information directly from the psychiatrist or whoever the a treating caregiver or provider might be, I'm sorry, you can suggest that you think these things are going on and you would hope that they try to be sensitive to it. The other possibility, which is kind of a little bit extreme, but in some cases is necessary, is to try to conserve the person if they're really struggling. It depends what level of planning has been done, but it is also possible if you know who the person's, say, stockbroker, accountant, lawyer is, you can also contact them and suggest that you're starting to have some concerns so that they maybe will be sensitive to them even if you cannot directly get information yourself.
Thank you very much for detailed information on a problem that we all don't want to face ourselves, and any family members that we know are in that situation really want to be able to do something about. Well, thank you very much for being here today. And so ends another discussion at the Commonwealth Club, and it's 111th year of enlightened discussion.